Welcome to Mandates and Megaphones, hosted by Jeremy Maggs. Unpacking the politics, promises, and power plays behind the G20 summit.
Hello and welcome to Mandates and Megaphones here on MoneyWeb in association with Standard Bank. I'm Jeremy Maggs, and as South Africa prepares to host the G20 Leaders Summit in Johannesburg this November, I want to ask a slightly harder question today. Can global promises actually narrow inequality here at home and, for that matter, across the continent? And in that respect, I'm joined by Isabel Fry, Senior Policy Advisor G20 at Oxfam South Africa and a social protection policy expert. And I want to try and get past slogans into a little bit of policy, money flows and power, what needs to change, by whom and by when. So Isabel, a very warm welcome to you. Let me start with a broad canvas question, if we can, and look at inequality and priorities. Is there one inequality debate, in your opinion, that this country should be putting first on the G20 agenda? And maybe tell me why.
Hello, Jeremy. It's wonderful to be speaking to you again. And I think the topic and the timing of this podcast is essential. It's hard. You want me to choose one priority. I would suggest that given a follow-up from the Brazilian G20 priority on taxation of the super rich, which was then endorsed in the June Financing for Development UN conference through the Civil Platform for Action on taxation of high net worth individuals, I really would like to see that being prioritized in this G20. We've seen over the years how the shift from public finance to private finance has really grown, and yet we've also seen a reduction in taxation. We know that the richest people pay the least tax, from Warren Buffett down. So to my mind, if the G20 is able to really come forward with a strong commitment to making this happen through the UN Tax Convention, for instance, I think that would be worthwhile.
It's a highly contestable idea, and one that I imagine would result in a lot of debate and disagreement. It would be difficult to get that onto an agenda, though, as important as it is.
It would be, but actually a lot of that work has already been done. I think President Lula, under the 2024 G20, advanced some of the recommendations from the specially constituted Zucman Tax Committee, which reported to the finance track last year. So it is on the global agenda. You're right, it's not an easy debate because that's really part of the inequality of wealth. Unhindered wealth is that you get elite compacts. So between the financially wealthy and the powerfully elite, you have compacts which come together and in fact hinder some of the national attempts to increase taxation. So what we're looking for is a global commitment, which then individual organizations, not individual organizations, but local organizations can really use to advance the debate at a national level. There's a fascinating organization called Patriotic Millionaires that was started in the US, which is made up of millionaires coming together and really committing to showing their support for greater taxation and also saying they won't flee with their wealth. So the inequality debate is interesting, Jeremy, because it's got two components. There's the pre-distribution and the redistribution. So taxation, of course, is a redistribution after the money is made. And that's, in fact, an easier ask. There's a growing wealth of data and research looking at pre-distribution, which is how do we equalize opportunities and access before profit is made. And I think really that is a hard ask, but I think both are essential.
How difficult is it to turn that inclusive growth debate that you're putting on the table into actual budgets with realistic deadlines, do you think?
Of course, debate is pretty, but action is hard work. So putting that into work really takes political will, but political will which is followed up by concrete oversight. The point of the G20, to my experience, having been part of government's development working group in the Sherpa track, is the the danger that because each year is a different presidency and it's sort of a moving caravan, that the continuity is lost. And one of the support mechanisms that the South African G20 presidency is pushing, at least at the Sherpa track, is for a standing oversight mechanism to happen. And I think that's really important. There are definite ways and examples of how we could ask for such things to happen. So the idea of having inequality action plans, for instance, at a national level, which would report up to an APEX oversight scorecard, I think would be an important point, which could have a location within the UN.
Do you think that South Africa has the wherewithal, the energy, and even the interest to drive as an important debate as you're raising onto that agenda? Because again, within South Africa, there are also lots of competing ideas, I presume.
Yes. I think the challenge is really that we're looking, as you say, at a global architecture with a national presidency that always has competing ideas. The trick, I would imagine, or the way forward would be for the South African presidency to be aware and driving a couple of priorities. And I mean, we see that in the thematic of solidarity, equality, and sustainability. So I know that the president appointed an expert committee of independent experts on global inequality. So we know that their report should be coming out in about October, and hopefully will be read into the record of this G20 with very strong recommendations. So that's one way that the South African government has, in effect, reached out for expert advice. So it doesn't have to be the driver of that. Again, the sustainability would be driven by the climate and energy justice component, and that, of course, has another leg in the COP30, which will be happening on a sort of pre-dovetailing with the G20 leaders summit. So the trick, I would imagine, would be to have really a good project management approach where people within the presidency are able to drive at a high level the sort of deep dive down through different actions that they have either originated or are aware of.
Could I pivot the conversation slightly to food and energy if we can? And maybe let's talk about food insecurity, which again is critical and particularly has relevance on this continent. When it comes to that, what do you think matters most? Is it pricing? Is it input? Or just poor logistics?
I think there are a variety of drivers around food insecurity. What we see in South Africa, for instance, is because of the deeply proletarianized demographic with people under colonialism and apartheid having been forced off the land. So we don't have a rural peasantry as much as other countries. The question of income poverty is a key driver. If you look more broadly at the continent, I think trade rules and agricultural subsidies definitely disadvantage Africa as a producer and a consumer. And one of the ways of looking at that for the G20 would be to commit to more equitable trade policies that favor African countries, again, as consumers and producers.
Do you think the G20 would be in a position to set binding commitments on food security the way it does maybe on financial stability, or was that a step too far?
The challenge, I would imagine, is that from the trade perspective, we've seen quite a collapse within the authority of the WTO. So with trade tariff policies that are coming out from the US, a lot of pre-negotiated agreements have been completely overhauled. The G20's authority, or sort of binding authority over such things, is not as binding as, for instance, the multilateral WTO, where, again, however, it's sort of by voluntary consensus that the power lies. So it is a deep challenge.
And food security is obviously inextricably linked to climate and energy. And one of the other big issues that will be discussed at the G20 is climate finance. And I guess the question is about whether new money will flow in, or whether global South countries are still being asked to do more with less, and that will be the sort of abiding narrative over the next couple of years.
Absolutely. I mean, the $100 billion climate pledge remains unmet, and we as Africa really need clarity on delivery timelines and mechanisms. I think if you look, for instance, at carbon border taxes for Africa, we need to either negotiate exemptions or, rather, even better still, secure transition support funds to green industries rather than just face punitive tariffs. The COP30 is looking at loss and damage and also as a source of financing. But I think it's true to say that the heyday of commitments of a couple of years ago really have been eviscerated without cash on the table. So there is a real danger that, in addition to the kind of punitive debt effects for Africa, climate and energy transitioning might be faced without secure financing, and unless, as the Africa group, we come together, as we did so effectively in the UN on debt, again, on the climate financing.
Let me push you a little bit on cash on the table and maybe steer me in a different direction if I'm misunderstanding you, but I look at it as the energy transition is often framed purely around investment. Is there one bigger governance reform, do you think, that the G20 could push that would make the transition fairer?
That is a hard ask. My approach to this year's G20 is really about securing promises that have already been made. I don't think the climate is ripe for new asks. And so I would really support just having a better timeline and actual ring-fenced figures put on the table for this year's G20 as a much more sustainable and doable ask.
Isabel, the other big thing, of course, is social protection and human development. And critical to that is gender inequality. That remains entrenched. Again, are you confident that this is the kind of issue that might be raised? And are there policy levers that will maybe quickly close the gender earnings and care gap? Or am I just being too altruistic here?
Well, you know that social protection is my passion.
Indeed.
And I was privileged to be on the development working group for the DPME for this year's G20. One of our priorities was social protection, and we managed to get consensus, which came out in the ministerial declaration, on the ILO recommendation 202. So in essence, the declaration commits G20 member states to embrace and advance recommendation 202, which is about social protection floors. So every country needs to have a basic social protection, which again, as per our constitution and as per the United Nations International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, would then be progressively expanded as countries grow richer, etc. So there's nothing new. In fact, that ILO recommendation 202 was initially introduced to the G20 in 2012 in the Mexican G20, but it is recognizing that with the growing vulnerability of workers because of the changing world of work, and recognizing the vulnerability of women particularly, and we the ministers mentioned in the declaration, the commitment to care, to recognition and reward for care work. There have been some very interesting reports, including from Oxfam, which really sort of map the contribution of women's unpaid labor, including and especially Black women, on a global level to enabling the sort of higher income earners and particularly men to go ahead and do so. I mean, if you're a middle class woman, you're working and you take time out to for social reproduction to have children, your pension contributions are affected in a way that nobody really recognizes. So that's for the elites. But right down to grassroots level for women who need to earn income through care work and leave their own children to the vagaries of a much more informal system. I mean, the impact of caring is really driving society, and we have an amazing sort of bi-weekly discussion on Sunday afternoons, we as Oxfam and New Economy Hub, looking at economy as care and really trying to invert how values and priorities are determined. Anyway, sorry, that's an aside, but I mean, you've touched on something which is core to the transformation and the transitioning that we need globally, which is to recognize that the deficits really affect women on an exorbitant, huge level, and how do we address that?
Isabel, you used two words at the beginning of that answer, embrace and advance. Is that enough?
So, again, I mean, sometimes when you have been in the same sort of going for the same priorities for a while, one can get discouraged. But I really believe that it's important that for the embracing and advancing is really, again, if you look at our constitution, the respect, protect, advance and fulfill. So what we've seen is a rollback on some of the fundamentals of recognition and embracing. So with the demise, for instance, of budgets looking at so basic social services, universal social services, there is an attack on both embracing and protecting, but possibly also going beyond that. And so again, the civil UN conference, there was a SPAR, Civil Platform for Action on Care, and that was ratcheting it up and saying that there needs to be a framework and sort of roadmap with dates and deliverables about how care is recognized and then rewarded.
I'd suggest to you that social protection also focuses or should be focusing, if it doesn't, on youth unemployment. I wonder whether you've given any thought to what kind of intervention scales the fastest. Is it public works? Is it SME finance? Skills to jobs pipelines? A combination of all three? Or do we need fresh thinking in that respect?
We've had a lot of thinking about the three options that you've put on the table. The huge challenge about, there are many challenges about youth unemployment, but a couple are firstly structural global unemployment. So the whole idea of full employment doesn't exist in all but a few industrialized economies. So where are jobs coming from? And then the skills around that. And I think if you look at the face of unemployment in South Africa, it's definitely young and it's definitely black. Now, companies are shedding jobs as new technology and, for instance, AI takes over. Where will jobs come from? I think that's the question we need to look at. And do we need to de-link income from jobs? And the future world of work, the ILO commission that President Ramaphosa sat on a couple of years ago, really threw out some recommendations about where work will be, and the services is one thing, but for that you need to have access to digital networks. You also need better access to training, but we must always remember that for jobs it's both supply and demand. So where is demand coming from? And I mean, even in South Africa, we have a lot of youth are fed into call centers, but with the rise of AI and bots and algorithms, that also faces future jeopardy. So what are the things that are required, and how do we then train people in and support the supply of that? I mean, if you look at Europe, they're facing the opposite of what we have. We have a youth bulge, a youth dividend. In Europe, unfortunately, the drive is to make services less and less employment driven because they anticipate not having employed population in the next 10, 15 years. So I think I really believe that new thinking is required, centered on the point of what we have and what we will need and how we supply that. I mean, one of the things that the continent has in abundance are minerals. How do we beneficiate those rather than exporting them? How do we not sell off the family jewels, so to say, but really maximize the enrichment for people and for countries that those profits have as a continent.
Isabel, on a broader canvas, and I certainly don't want to sabotage anything before it's even started, but does Oxfam think the G20 is still the right forum to address inequality, or do you think there's a danger that it's too dominated by the interests of the richest economies?
Your questions are always so kind of full of different aspects, points to them. So the question I think behind that is there a value in multilateralism right now? We've seen many attempts to undermine multilateralism and sort of single powers and countries either walking out or seeking to veto. And I think that's something that needs to be looked at. As Oxfam, we are really committed to reinvigorating multilateralism, but also looking at making the power and value distribution fairer. So looking at the sort of global financial architecture needs and representation needs to be fairer. The G20 is important. I mean, there are many valuable criticisms that say that it's exclusive, it's elitist, it's looking at the larger economies. But then again, the AU is sitting at G20 as a permanent member for the first time, and it's been amazing seeing how that space has really been taken up, and that needs to be affirmed. Possibly as the EU is weakened as a political bloc, we might see the AU coming through as a stronger, more determined bloc there. So yeah, multilateralism is critical, because the alternative is a fragmentation and a real sort of reversion to boorish, brutish, nasty in short, which is kind of a life without social contracts. So political contracts are important, but so I think is the need for countries that have not had dominant voices to gain a confidence and also to look at reconstituting alliances and allies. I mean, I mentioned the Africa Group and their role at the UN on debt. Looking again at debt, just looking for the need to possibly form a debtors club, which counterbalances the creditors club. And so in that way uses the G20 in a much more sophisticated manner than has been allowed in the past.
So let me drop a final question to you then. What would Oxfam's message to leaders be who claim that tackling inequality, as we've been discussing, is either too expensive or politically impossible?
I would say that if we look at 2025, we've all seen sentences about the growing polycentric crises which are facing us in terms of oligarchy, in terms of unilateral action. Inequality has definitely contributed to the way in which the most powerful continue to act in a way that is unaccounted and has devastating impacts on individuals, countries, and the planet. And putting inequality, we just open our future up to greater and greater vulnerabilities to the kinds of power attacks that we've seen. So it's really a question of going back to basics. And there have been times in our recent sort of modern history where people have come together and said, we cannot allow this to happen again. And so we need to put all the resources that we have to do that. We really believe this is really the moment now for inequality. And having had involvement in a couple of sort of recent initiatives, such as last year's G20, the Financing for Development, and being really involved in this year's G20, it's encouraging to see that there are other countries that believe the same. And so as Oxfam, we really are calling for a coalition of the willing, of leaders who want to invest in a better future to come together and to provide that leadership, but also that mutual protection of organizing together. So that would be our statement, that we need a coalition of the willing to stand up and say we're willing to tackle inequality with real actions, not just rhetoric. I mean, in South Africa, we've seen rhetoric, but we've also had discussions with the president around the inequality issue. The fact that he has appointed an independent panel of global experts, so not just the regional or national, is really encouraging. And we believe that certain countries, including Brazil and Spain, will really be behind the recommendations that come out of this. But we would also, as Oxfam, say there needs to be a standing body, possibly at the United Nations, similar to the climate IPCC, of independent experts that meet on an annual basis to look at the reductions in inequality, the new challenges, and to be ahead of the curve.
Thank you very much indeed. That was Mandates and Megaphones on MoneyWeb in association with Standard Bank. My thanks to Oxfam South Africa's Isabel Fry. So as South Africa hosts the G20 at the real test, as Isabel was telling us, it's not about rhetoric. It isn't about speeches. It's where the promises turn into action that cuts equality where people live. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you for listening to Mandates and Megaphones. You can find more episodes on moneyweb.co.za.